Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for an hour of medical discussion, debate, dialogue, healthcare and science in the news, and, well, who knows what's coming down on the waves, the airwaves, that is. And before we go any further, we do need to remind you that what comes down on the airwaves represents the opinions of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, what comes down on the airwaves is intended for education and entertainment. It is not necessarily intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Oh my goodness, hasn't it been an interesting break we've had from talking about healthcare reform? And I'm sorry, we're back. President Obama has presented a bill that is going to be considered and very well may pass. Let's just start by saying that conciliation is Vox speak for go ahead and filibuster until you drop. See how many votes you get in November for that. In other words, the Democrats have learned Orwellian doublespeak. For those of you who are not familiar with George Orwell's 1984, I highly recommend you read it. It is a beautiful exposition of how you make things real by calling them the opposite of what they actually are. A really, really fascinating book. So the Obama plan, as it was presented this week, meets, as far as I'm concerned, the minimum qualifying bar. It qualifies in terms of its times, in terms of what it's doing. And yeah, it's a minimum, but given how uphill a climb it has been to get anywhere, I would love to see this pass because it includes those minimum qualifying factors we've been talking about for 2 years. It includes a mandate to individuals with a penalty and a mandate to employers, at least those employers who have more than 50 employees. And for those with less than 50 employees, it has incentives to make them want to purchase health care benefits for their employees. All to the good. It also includes subsidies for the 45 million uninsured people. And it makes, this is key, it makes members of Congress use the same buying pool, the same healthcare supermarket as independent purchasers. In other words, the people who have had the biggest advantage and therefore have been completely out of the loop in terms of understanding the deterioration of healthcare in this country are going to be squarely placed with the least advantaged, that is to say, the individual purchasers. I'm really looking forward to that. In addition, we had some interesting things come down in California. Dianne Feinstein actually introduced legislation that would allow the federal government to say to a health plan, you know what? You can't raise your rates that much. You made an obscene, over $2.5 billion profit last year, Anthem, and you can't raise the rates because you have one losing division in your company that isn't making a profit. So bad, so sad, not allowed. Now, there's a really interesting article, which I highly recommend to you, appeared in the Wall Street Journal this week, and it was a conservative critique of the Obama plan. It was in, let's see, February 19th, Wall Street Journal. The author is Jason Fodeman, F-O-D-E-M-A-N. And it's a long article, but it lays out really well the conservative position, including having the basic flaws of the conservative position. So we're going to kind of analyze that for a couple of minutes. First of all, paraphrasing the title of the article, it's sort of why the Obama plan won't save money. And as usual, the conservative position is based on two very deeply flawed premises. The first premise is justice doesn't matter. Now, the uninsured in this article are just ignored. And I'm sorry, but you can't have the greatest healthcare system in the world if you ignore one-fifth of your population. I want to draw the analogy to the utility companies. Okay, here's a critique of pure profit, to paraphrase a famous philosopher. If you are doing business with a service that is something that everybody in the population should have access to by any kind of moral precept, then part of the cost of doing business is providing it. At the time that FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt was elected, a large percentage, something like 20 to 30% of households in the United States didn't have electricity. This is in the 1930s, guys. Why didn't they? Well, because it wasn't profitable to run the electric wires out to people in remote rural areas. I'm sorry, but if you want to be running an electrical company and selling electricity in the cities, guess what? It's part of your business plan that you're going to supply it where we tell you to. You are a utility company. And I do believe that we should reframe health care and health insurance, particularly as a utility. People have a right to electricity, and they have a right to a phone line, and they have a right to health care. End of discussion. It's a justice issue. Another one of the great premises that's missed here is that we hold up this concept of freedom of choice as a sacred cow. You know what? Freedom of choice is a meaningless value when it's applied to poverty or illness. People don't have a choice to be poor or a choice to get sick. They would choose otherwise. This is social Darwinist nonsense. So now let's talk a little bit about some of the systems dynamics, because that's where this article really shines. It talks about how if we start providing health care to everyone, the costs are going to go up. And indeed, that is absolutely true. There will be an increase in health care costs, and it will take a decade or more for us to see a decrease in the cost curve. That's because we have a huge, an unimaginable pool of unmet need, of disease prevalence that is out there but not identified. Hypertensives, diabetics, undiscovered cancers that are just walking around in the population, assuming that they're healthy and haven't been checked for 20 years. That's the front-loaded cost. In the long run, as we coordinate a system and mandate benefits on the basis of justification, showing that they improve the healthcare status of the population, we will see a great deal of cost dropping, and we will see a rationalization of the system. It's going to take a while, however, for that to occur. There are a lot of other things in this article that we could talk about, and I will try over the next few weeks to do that, but we're already picking up some callers, and I need to acknowledge that we've all heard a lot about this topic, and sometimes you just got to know when to stop. Let me finish with a little thought problem for you. When you start doing cost effectiveness analysis, or you start trying to figure out what the best way to take care of people is, be very, very careful about how you ask the question. As the health plans have discovered and demonstrated in the last 10 years, the best way to keep your costs down is simply to deny care, calling all care unnecessary. It's a really, really great way to reduce costs, but it sort of misses the point of health insurance. Another way to do it is to look for your cost per case. But there's problems with that, because again, if you spend less money, you have less cost per case. And if you don't have a downside to doing that, like counting deaths against that number, well, you end up again with this false premise of cheaper is better. A better way to look at it might be cost per year of life saved. And we can, I think, start socially agreeing that if you save a useful year of productive life, that's a win, even though it costs you money to do it. A good example of this is the great victory we've had in the last 10 years in taking care of acute myocardial infarction, something that many people will experience in their lifetime. Roughly 50% of you will have a heart attack and eventually die of cardiac-related illnesses. That's the current statistic. But dying of your first heart attack has become rare, and being disabled from your first heart attack has also become much rarer than it used to be. Over the years, we have spent more money per case, and the cost of taking care of a heart attack has gone way, way up. On the other hand, we have spent less money per year of life saved, because more people's lives have been saved and they haven't died. That's a win, even though it represents increased costs. So we need to be careful as we debate this issue to examine the basic premises. Are we going for justice and saving productive years in the population, or are we going for keeping the cost down across the board? Very different. and very important to keep it straight in your head. And let's go to Heidi. Hello, Heidi, and welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning.
First of all, I'd like to say please don't stop talking about health insurance, because I'm one of those individual buyers and of Anthem, and we're getting, of course, our rates raised again astronomically.
39%.
You know, this has been going on for a long time, and this is the second raise in a year, but it seems to have captured everyone's imagination, so I'm grateful for that.
I think it was the timing.
Yes, I do too.
I think it was the timing. It's like, okay, we're going to backburner healthcare reform. Oh, great. Let's just go ahead and profiteer some more.
I guess. Well, my own opinion is that if they're saying that they can't provide the service they've already abdicated, so just get them out of the way. But that isn't why I called. This is a follow-up call to last week. I called you about my 87-year-old mother who's contemplating having a shoulder replacement.
Right.
So I had them get some more information, and she walks with crutches, and she's really in very severe pain. She has shooting pains in her shoulder. She has arthritis mainly, but not, there's nothing apparently wrong with the rotator cuff. She's tried cortisone injections twice, and they last for about 2 weeks. She also has a prescription for tramadol, and she takes that at night. She doesn't take it during the day.
Because?
Because I think that age group doesn't take medications.
Well, if she has an effective pain medication and she does not get overly drowsy or have balance issues using it, then using it during the day would seem to me, when she's walking and needing her crutches, would seem to me to be a smart move. For the audience who wasn't listening last week, this 80-something-year-old lady has to walk with crutches and is suffering from severe shoulder arthritis from a lifetime of crutch use. So back to the question of whether she gets a shoulder replacement. First of all, I'm not sure that shoulder replacements are going to work for someone with crutches. I don't know enough about the dynamics of the shoulder replacement, whether or not, in fact, the design will support you supporting weight in that way on a long-term daily basis, or whether that would fatigue out the structure and cause it to fail or dislocate. And that's a technical question that I am unable to answer, but certainly it's very true that shoulder replacements are a new technology, that they are not designed to weight bear. They're designed to swing your arm and allow you to use your arm. So I'm not sure that it would handle the load, but presumably somebody who's working with her thinks it would, and I would defer to that decision. But when you're looking at the period of immobility in that arm after a joint replacement, don't imagine it's like taking out the carburetor in a car, and that she will be able to walk with crutches the next day or the next week or the next month. I think that's
6 weeks.
I think that's really unlikely, and that 6 weeks is for rehabilitation for a shoulder replacement. It's not for returning to crutch walking.
Right.
We don't have data on that. There aren't enough people getting shoulder replacements who need crutches. During that 6 weeks, she's got a lot of mobility issues. Can she walk or get around with just one arm?
Probably not.
Okay. So she's wheelchair-bound or bed-bound with DVT prophylaxis and a very high risk of a blood clot just from the virtue of the immobility. Plus, during that time, when she's not on her feet at her age, she's going to lose muscle mass from her legs and particularly the hip flexors. So she's going to need very, very intensive physical therapy so that she doesn't lose the ability to walk below the waist while you're waiting for her arm to come back. So my advice is still, if pain is the primary problem here, then you haven't gone far enough. She hasn't gone far enough with her conservative management of the pain.
Okay, so again, that age, they're worried about things like addiction.
She should worry about dying on the operating room table or getting a post-op pneumonia, way more than that. As far as being worried about addiction, you know, that goes back to old reefer madness propaganda that her generation was subject to. And I don't know how you can convince her, but the data on pain control basically says, and maybe she can parse this if you frame it this way for her, that if you're taking a pain pill because you're in pain and it takes away your pain, then your brain doesn't make a positive association with the pain pill. It's a neutral association.
Oh, it doesn't, you're not doing it to get high.
You're not doing it to get high, and the part of your brain that gets addicted doesn't get addicted because it sees the pain as a negative and it associates the drug with the pain.
Okay.
So it just doesn't happen. I mean, there are plenty,
right. Okay.
There's plenty of research. What will happen is that her body, which is not being trained, her body is basically an automated machine to break down drugs. And so her body will develop tolerance. And after a year or 2 years, she'll have to increase the dose. Yes, she might need, after a couple of years, to increase the dose. That's a physiological effect due to her body getting used to it. It's just like when you started drinking alcohol. Ask her about her brother when he started drinking, and he drank one beer and got completely bonkers when he was 14. But then by the time he was 28 and he was doing a six-pack a day, you couldn't even tell because his body adapted to the alcohol.
Okay.
And so there's body adaptation and there's brain adaptation.
Right.
And they're different.
Okay, so let me just ask you one thing. I know you have other calls. So are we looking here for, if she gets the cortisone and she took that without pain medication, she didn't get much relief. Are we looking for a combination of cortisone and pain medication?
Absolutely. You're looking at, first of all, you want to use a long-term anesthetic and the cortisone when she gets the injections. She should be on some kind of regular pain medication throughout the 24-hour cycle.
Okay.
And if you can find an anti-inflammatory, that would be an excellent idea, something her stomach will tolerate. That would be a good idea because what you're trying to do here is reduce the inflammation. Glucosamine and chondroitin would be worth a try for her. They can help with lubricating the joint, and in some people they have a fairly phenomenal pain control aspect. She should try acupuncture. I think everybody should try acupuncture for arthritis before they have a joint replacement. 50% of the time, in my practice at least, I'd say about 50% of the time, you can avoid joint replacement. And of course, I'm not dealing scientifically here. I'm dealing with a selected, highly motivated population who are paying me out of their pocket for acupuncture, so they want to avoid it. And that's not, you know, a scientific assessment, but just in personal anecdotal experience, it can be pretty effective. I see joint replacement as a last resort, but it's being pushed a little early in her therapeutic curve. And I'm thinking it's being a little bit oversold here. That's just my opinion.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Good luck.
I'll call them back and see what they say.
Well, you know, you're probably not going to get satisfaction. You're just the pesky family member.
No, actually, she called me for advice.
Okay.
Which is highly unusual, so I'm going to take advantage of that.
All right. The door was open then.
Go for it.
All right.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. Before we go to our next caller, I just want to read two relevant emails. This one from Grace in Santa Cruz, who has two issues regarding cervixes, but two different cervixes. I'm a 46-year-old female that had disc surgery on my neck in 2007. She can turn her head to drive, but bending the head is painful, and so is carrying more than 7 pounds. And she also has cervical, as in uterine cervix, dysplasia, which her doctor has been monitoring, checking every 3 to 4 months to monitor its progress in case it should go cancerous. Well, I'm kind of questioning that one, but I'm about to cancel my health insurance as I can no longer afford it. My coverage with United Health Choice Plus has spiked from its initial $285 a month in 2007 to $465. I'm not yet at a full-time job since the discectomy, and my question is, what are my medical options and state financial medical options? Well, if you're working 2 days a week, you're probably making too much money to qualify for Medicare or Medicaid, and you are part of the great uninsured independent purchasing pool, which is why they were able to double your health insurance rates over 2 years, and part of where that $2.5 billion in profit came from. If you cancel your insurance, supposedly there is a policy in Congress passed last year that will protect you from being unable to purchase insurance with a pre-existing condition. But there is absolutely no guarantee that when you go back to buy insurance, it won't be $950, which I'm guessing be unaffordable to you. And you have a medical problem which is really critical, cervical dysplasia. If I were an actuary, I'd look at you and say, this lady's likely to have cancer surgery. I'm not touching her. So I don't know what to tell you, Grace. If you cancel your insurance, it's kind of crazy right now. My advice is, while you've got the insurance, stick it to them and get your cervical dysplasia taken care of more aggressively. I like conservative management under ordinary circumstances, but cervical dysplasia can be treated with laser, it can be treated with a loop excision, it can be treated with a cryo, and yes, there's a downside risk to cervical scarring, but then you're pretty much done. And while it won't help your insurability very much to have had a treated cervical dysplasia, you'll still be an insurance leper as far as they're concerned. The chances that it will progress to cervical cancer, and you'll end up having to try to foot the cost for your hysterectomy and your chemotherapy, is eliminated or close to eliminated. So you've got to factor in that when you ask yourself this question about stopping the insurance. My advice would be, talk to your doctor about being more aggressive about managing the cervical dysplasia. Sometimes more aggressive is necessary for economic reasons. Let's go to Anne in Santa Cruz. Anne, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
And don't stop talking about healthcare.
Okay,
I
will.
You need it. My problem is, I have this funny sore spot on the bottom of my foot, underneath, right by my second and third toes on my left foot. If I touch it, if I push on it, it's sore, and my two toes are sore.
If you push on the top, is it sore or the bottom?
The bottom.
Okay, go ahead.
And I've had sciatica in that leg that's getting better, and like sometimes the top part of my foot above my instep is sore. It's not right now. But what seems to persist is that sore spot under those two toes.
Mm-hmm.
It's been months.
Okay. And I would ask one question for diagnostic purposes.
Mm-hmm.
You might have to take your sock off to test this.
Okay.
Take a very light piece of cotton or a Kleenex or your hair if it's long enough. But anyway, something really soft and light, and brush on top of the foot between the two toes and do it on the other side at the same time and see if there's a difference in the sensation, if it feels altered there compared to the other side.
Okay, that sounds...
If it does...
Sounds like an IQ test.
Well, no, not really. But remember what they said about Gerald Ford, you know...
No, I don't.
Oh, it was like walking and chewing gum at the same time. And poor guy.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Okay, now tell me again. I've got something light.
Okay, so you run a wispy something across the skin on both sides at the same time, and you see if it feels the same or different.
Above my toes?
Top of the toes, yeah. Sort of in the web space where the toes join is the best place to check.
Oh, yeah, it's the same.
It's the same, okay.
Mm-hmm.
If it were different, then I would say it's a slam dunk diagnosis that you have a Morton's neuroma, M-O-R-T-O-N. You can look that up.
Mm-hmm.
That particular location is really prone to developing a nodule on the nerve. And then, of course, because the bones of the toes are wide at that point, the nodule gets squeezed and you get pain.
Mm-hmm.
Another possibility is a metatarsal subluxation. And this is where the tendons and ligaments stretch out and the bone actually drops down a little bit. And it's pounding when you walk. It's actually pounding against the pavement.
Mm-hmm.
And that will often cause a callus to occur under that area on the foot. So that's a clue, which you may or may not have.
No,
but
don't have that.
Those are the two possibilities. If it's a Morton's neuroma, the first thing I have people do is get a wider shoe.
Mm-hmm.
So you get stand on a piece of cardboard and have someone draw a circle around your foot, draw the outline of your foot, and then you measure that and get yourself a plastic ruler and cut it off. And then you don't wear any shoes that you can't put the plastic ruler inside right across the widest part of the front of the shoe.
Mm-hmm.
So effectively what you've done is you've stopped squeezing it.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing you do when the cat is crying because you're standing on its tail, you take your foot off the cat's tail.
Mm-hmm.
So if the nerve is crying because you're squeezing it, you try to stop squeezing the nerve.
Mm-hmm.
If you do that for a week or two and the pain gets better, then you're on the road to recovery. Keep it up.
Right.
Some people find that an arch support is also helpful in this regard. If you've been wandering around in thin-soled shoes without arch support, you can give that a shot as well. Speaking of giving it a shot, that's the next strategy that you do with Morton's Neuromas. You throw a little cortisone into the area and you try to take down any swelling that might be contributing to the pressure on the nerve. And that's effective some of the time. The third option is surgical. If the pain is bad enough and not resolving with conservative measures, then you can remove the neuroma. Generally, that doesn't cause any disability, but you do lose sensation in the area distal to where the neuroma was removed. So you'll have a numb toe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, having a numb second or third toe is only a problem if you, you know, get a tack in it or you get a blister and you don't realize it and it gets infected.
Right.
Otherwise, if you're non-diabetic, it's not such a big deal. So those would be the possibilities for your foot pain.
Okay.
If we've covered that, then I'll wish you a good day. And
yep, you've covered it.
All right, we'll go on with the program then.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Thanks, bye.
Let's take a moment to answer another health-related email. This one from Michelle in Live Oak. Another person without health insurance. I'm a 35-year-old woman. I haven't had insurance offered at a job in for over a decade. So for the most part, I eat well, exercise, don't smoke, drink excessively, or do drugs. And I've been keeping my head above water. It's a good thing because when I needed Medicruz, I just barely make enough to disqualify, like our previous person. So I wait out acute pains and suffering, use over-the-counter supplements and herbs, and pray my lifestyle will keep any potential chronic diseases at bay. My lifestyle is my healthcare plan. I'd love to hear your top 10 lifestyle recommendations for those of us without insurance. Well, it might even be for those with insurance. Your suggestions for probiotics and vitamin D have gotten me through the last couple of years fairly unscathed. After trying out a non-gluten, non-dairy diet for the last 8 months, it's really made me a whole new person. I'll never turn back. I just can't afford to get sick or miss work. I'd appreciate hearing about your priorities for food, hydration, and supplements. Well, I'm going to start, Michelle, by talking about, at 35, what your risks are. Okay, and your risks are basically cervical cancer and trauma, motor vehicle accident, bicycle accident, safety, safety, safety. Be careful climbing ladders. Don't be foolish. If you do any kind of extreme sports, you want to rethink that because a broken leg or some other, you know, relatively non-life-threatening thing is going to put you in the poorhouse or at least put you deeply in debt. So you want to think safety, wear your helmets, etc. And I believe that if you're low risk, don't smoke, and have never had cervical dysplasia like our previous person, that a liquid phase pap smear every 3 years is an absolute necessity. And that's probably, you know, at a women's clinic, if you had to pay top dollar, you know, $100, $120. So not horribly unaffordable and definitely worth it. Another thing is to monitor your blood pressure. I'm assuming you don't have any major family history of diseases. If you do, then there are specific recommendations we would make. But, you know, if your uncle died of colon cancer at 45, obviously we're going to think differently about colon cancer screening than we would for the whole population. Most pharmacies have a blood pressure machine that you can just sit down and use free of charge. I would recommend getting a quarterly blood pressure and tracking it. Now, in terms of ways to stay healthy, I'm sure you're already doing many of these, but let's go over them. Exercising at least 20 minutes 3 times a week, and that could even be just a brisk walk. It's also important as a female to do weight-bearing exercises, and that could be jumping rope or just walking, making maybe a brisk walk or some jumping jacks. The stretching is really important for avoiding injuries. I would add some form of relaxation on a regular daily or at least every other day basis, 15 minutes of deep breathing, meditation, visualization, tai chi, yoga. So many things are out there. The point is a regular practice of bringing yourself into a relaxed state is extremely good for you and will help you avoid a lot of the chronic diseases that we're talking about. Good diet, avoiding a lot of high glycemic index foods, a lot of starch, very important for preventing diabetes, as is maintaining a body weight under a BMI of 26. And those, there are BMI or body mass index profiles all over the internet. You can plug in your numbers and see what you've got. I would recommend eating a regular breakfast every day that includes protein. I would further recommend 5 to 7 servings of fruits and vegetables every day, preferably organic. If you can't afford organic, then there are lists that will tell you which fruits and vegetables are the ones that have the least pesticide residue, and those are the ones to buy non-organic. I would also recommend an omega-3 fatty acid supplement, or if you're a vegetarian, 3 tablespoons of flaxseed freshly ground on a daily basis, or 1,000 milligrams minimum of omega-3 fatty acid. All of these recommendations have good scientific basis for reducing and preventing the eruption of chronic disease. Your mission, Michelle, assuming we don't see healthcare reform, is to stay healthy until 65 when Medicare kicks in. At that point, your chronic diseases will be paid for by the government, which, if you're a strict conservative, is still one of the most popular programs ever invented. Just a little editorializing on the healthcare system before we go to our next caller. Medicare passed by 55 to 45, and it was filibustered. The Civil Rights Act passed by an even smaller margin, and it was filibustered for something like over a month. Sometimes change is hard. Sometimes you've got to just be forceful in doing the right thing. You can't always get consensus. There is an environmental working group webpage that has a guide to what foods have the most and least pesticides, and we have a link to that on the website. So our website, askdrdawn.com, you can link to that to the foods with the most and least pesticides to help you be cost-effective in your search to minimize your risk. And we're going to Liz in Santa Cruz. Hello, Liz, and welcome to the program.
Hi. My question is, I had a muscle injury. It seems to be the hamstring attachment at the top of the back of my hamstring where it attaches to the pelvis. I slipped, caught myself with that muscle, and it hurt after that.
Mm-hmm.
About 6 weeks ago. So I've been taking it easy, re-injured it once, when I tripped, and again, that muscle kind of clenched up, and it was getting better, and then I re-injured it yesterday very, very badly when I was dancing, and wondering if I should continue to move, or should I try not to move too much? Should I rest it today? Should I start swimming today? I don't know what to do.
All right. Did you fall, or was it like you did a high kick and it suddenly was talking to you?
I did a little kick to the side. I twisted the leg sort of laterally in a move. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I didn't fall.
You got excited and, were grooving.
Yeah.
You were grooving with the beat.
Yeah.
Yeah, we got the weekend warrior and we got the weekend boogier. Okay, you have weekend boogie syndrome. All right, so it was getting better, and you've re-injured it. It's re-inflamed. First thing is you're describing what you think is a hamstring injury. Those are notorious for re-inflaming and re-injuring.
Mm.
So part of the rehab for any hamstring injury is a long course of stretching. Even when it no longer hurts, you've got to keep stretching it so that it heals out to distance.
I do yoga about 5 times a week,
okay.
And I try not to, re-injure when I do that.
All right. And the pain in the back of your is in the back of your leg. And
yes.
Does it also affect you on that bone of your pelvis, the ischium that's where the bicycle seat hits?
Yeah, it does. Yeah. It's a little worse today. Yeah.
Okay. But that's above the area where you're having the most pain?
I guess it's a little bit above. It's hard to tell. It's kind of deep. It's really, really deep.
Okay. Because the possibility is that you have a muscle strain. That would be a hamstring strain or tear. The other possibility is that you have an insertional tendonitis, where the tendon of the hamstring that's going into the bone, think about a tree sending its roots into the ground. That's how a tendon, it sends these little roots into the bone, and if you grab the tree and gave it a good shake, you'd loosen the connections of the roots. You've pulled weeds up. So if you've got that, that's going to take much longer to resolve, and it's going to be more subject to re-injury.
Mm-hmm.
Personal anecdote, I call it the curse of the Sphinx. Several years ago, I was in Egypt at the Sphinx, jumping around on some rocks, trying to get the perfect framing of my picture, and I slipped. And I fell down, and I rammed into a couple of other people and as I fell and knocked them down. Did not endear me to my tour group. And I hurt, boom, sat down hard, bruised the area of the ischium. Then we then went across a 3-day cross-country, bumpy, 4-wheel drive trip to the desert. And that thing still bothers me. If I stop and think about it, I'm always stretching my hamstring. And it's just, you know, a little reminder, like I said, the curse of the Sphinx. It could be worse. Mm-hmm. But these things do tend to become chronic, and stretching is really important. When mm-hmm. you do re-injure it, you need to rest. Ice is really important. Mm-hmm. Cross massage. So, yeah, absolutely, you take it easy. Do exercises that don't use the hamstring.
Okay. Swim tomorrow. Maybe give it a day of rest? Or you know.
Well, I think you can swim light, you know, be very light about it. And if mm-hmm. it's starting to hurt, swimming is pretty low impact, but don't go for mm-hmm. speed.
Right.
Do,
right.
you know, kind of do breaststroke and kind of
mm-hmm. slow laps.
Slow laps. Use your arms. The key is if you want to swim, is use the float between your knees so that
right.
you're really
okay.
not using your leg very much, but you're getting your exercise.
That's a good idea. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Take it easy. Give it some time. I usually will tell people when you acutely recur like that, I love nonsteroidals short term for that sort of thing. You know, 3 mm-hmm. ibuprofen over the counter with food. Because you never mm-hmm. want to do it without food. So over-the-counter doses of ibuprofen with each meal 3 times a day.
How much? About 600 milligrams or 800? Or
400 milligrams is the maximum that I could recommend on a radio
mm-hmm.
program.
Mm-hmm.
If I were seeing you in the office, I might recommend a higher dose, but that would mm-hmm. be giving you medical advice over the air. So
okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Let's go to Valerie in Aptos. Hello, Valerie. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Don.
Hi.
I have been a little concerned the last few months. I am also one of your frequent listeners that does not have insurance, but I am on acyclovir, and I have been having great problems trying to get that prescription.
Oh, yes. Yes, it has been a real challenge because the manufacturing of acyclovir kind of got halted, and I'm not sure what the issue is. I haven't really searched it out, but usually what happens with these things is that an inspection finds a problem at the factory, maybe a leak, some kind of cross-contamination, and they have to shut down the factory and fix it. With a generic drug, there may be only 2 or 3 companies making it, and if one of the major suppliers shuts down, once you go through the backlog supply, you've got a problem. So people are having to switch over to Valacyclovir, Valtrex, or Famcyclovir, which is Famvir, and both of those are more expensive. And naturally, their manufacturers have been making it at a certain baseline rate based on the market demand. When that demand suddenly doubles or triples, you got a problem.
Right.
You've come up dry at your local pharmacy for both drugs or just for the acyclovir?
Well, for the acyclovir, Costco's been out of it, and then they sent me over to Westside, and I've been able to get it there for the last 2 months. But unfortunately, I'm someone who, when I go off of it,
you have an outbreak.
Freak out.
Right.
Yeah.
So those 3 drugs, you've got 3 drugs that'll work. They have different doses.
Yeah.
You have a regular doctor?
Yes.
Okay. So I would suggest that you ask them to give you a written prescription for all 3 at your suppression dose
right.
so that you can shop around to different pharmacies. This will get fixed. It's not forever, but I don't know how long it will take.
Okay.
It's kind of like when they scrub a mission at NASA because, you know, they've got a problem. It's like, okay,
yeah.
well, when will it be fixed? It'll be fixed when it's fixed.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're working as fast as we can, but
yeah.
it'll be fixed when it's fixed, and we can't really tell you. And that's kind of the situation.
Yeah, they did tell me that one of the drugs was like $300, and you know, Costco I can get it for $14, and the other place I can get it for about $25. So.
Exactly. Well, the point is, if you had to pay $300 to avoid a herpes outbreak, could you? For 1 month, let's say.
1 month, I could probably handle that.
Right.
But,
so
yeah.
hopefully it won't come to that. You know, there's the Canadian pharmacy, Dodge. If worse comes to worse, you can hold your nose and go online and try to find, quote-unquote, drugs from Canada, which are probably coming from India. But they're still the drug, or probably, you know,
yeah.
they're probably still the drug. Or you could get in your car and drive across the border and buy it in Mexico. You know, these are ridiculous
yeah.
sorts of strategies.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Let's see. What's an airplane ticket to Mexico City cost? Probably about $300 round
yeah,
trip.
Huh?
Wouldn't that
so,
be?
Yeah, and I've only been able to find 800s too. My dose is 400, so I just cut them in half. But
that's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fine. You can do that. Totally fine. There's always a tenuous supply issue with these things that we don't ever think about until something happens.
Mm-hmm.
Valacyclovir will be going generic soon, but I don't think it's generic yet. Because there's only one generic version, people like yourself get crunched during these shortages, and I'm deeply sorry that's happening to you.
It's been quite a few months, too, so I was just, you know, concerned as how long this is going to last, so...
I wish I knew.
All right, thank you so much, Dr. Dawn.
Well, I hope I've given you some useful ideas.
Yeah, you did. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Dave in Boulder Creek. Hello, Dave. Welcome to the program.
Hello, thank you. It's good to be here.
Can I say that again? Hello, Dave.
I just want to say, first of all, I have very good health insurance, but I definitely believe that it should be a right enjoyed by all, and I, for one, am willing to sacrifice to allow others to have this right. And so I agree. Keep talking about it.
Thank you. And thank you for saying that you'd actually be willing to give something up so that other people could have something.
Oh, very definitely. Very definitely. I mean, anyway, my problem is, okay, I'm 50 years old and I'm a runner. I've been running my entire life. About a year and a half ago, I started getting a pain deep in the buttocks. And when I ran, the pain radiated all the way down my legs.
Uh-huh.
So I went to a physical therapist, and I went to my doctor first, and then he referred me to a physical therapist, and we kind of determined that this was piriformis syndrome.
Yes, indeed. That's what it sounds like.
Okay, so I went to the physical therapist for a period of about 2 or 3 months, and the pain completely went away. I was able to run for about 6 months. I had no pain whatsoever, and then all of a sudden, the pain came back.
Mm-hmm.
And this was maybe about 6 months ago, so the pain came back, and now, it's for like the last 6 months, it's like I never know from day to day if there's going to be pain or not. Like I might go a week and there's no pain, and then all of a sudden the pain shows up again. And I might go out for a run tomorrow and there's no pain, and then Monday it's pain again. And I know it's not an injury. I'm pretty sure it's not arthritis. And so I come back to the piriformis syndrome, but I'm just wondering what is it that makes it so unpredictable?
Well, I suspect that there's some unidentified thing that you're doing that is just biodynamically a bad idea and that you haven't identified it. And a couple of things were running through my head because you're a runner. Shoes and surfaces. So if a person, for example, is running sometimes on one side of the street that's canted a little bit, or they're doing some cross country, or they're going up and down curves, or they do one route that has a lot of uphill and then that's not their typical route. There are just a lot of possibilities floating around out there about your flares. But I suspect that without realizing it, you're doing something that is actuating the flare up. Okay. Now, piriformis syndrome happens because there are these deep muscles in the pelvis that connect basically from the inside of the pelvis, from the sacral area, across the femur to the hip bone, and they rotate the hip. And so when you're running, you're turning your foot a little bit, you're adjusting for the angles, you're going up a little higher, coming down a little lower on one side. So there's all these factors that are causing some rotation of the hip as you run. And the muscle has two bands, if you will, that act as rotators, and the sciatic nerve runs between the bands. And so you can imagine kind of sawing away at the nerve with these muscles as you rotate your hip back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And the nerve gets irritated by the friction. And that triggers the piriformis syndrome. So you have to figure out, what am I doing that's whipsawing the nerve too much? Is it just volume of exercise? Is it the way I'm running that particular day? But I think there's a factor there you haven't identified. And it could just be duration of run. But whatever it is, there's something that's causing this intermittent triggering. And if you can figure that out, it would be great, because then you cannot do that.
Right.
But while you're trying to figure it out, when you do flare it up, you want to start stretching. And I'm sure the physical therapist taught you some piriformis stretches.
Mm-hmm.
And those should be done every day anyway, but you want to ramp up your stretching once you've flared it. Because as it heals and the inflammation goes down, there's a tendency for the muscle to tighten further, and that's obviously a vicious cycle, so you don't want to go there. The second thing is, when you flare it, lots of anti-inflammatories and sitting on ice bags. Because when you're seated, you can get the ice pretty close to the piriformis muscle.
Mm-hmm.
And that'll reduce the inflammation in the region.
Okay. my physical therapist thinks I'm insane because I'll come in 1 week and like, oh my God, it's killing me. And then the next week, oh, it's fine. And neither one of us have been able to figure out why. So,
where do you live?
Boulder Creek.
Okay. There's a sports medicine doctor down in South Santa Cruz County named Warren Scott.
Warren Scott, okay.
And there's a physical therapist named Ronning. And
yeah, that's where I go.
Okay. If they can't figure out what you're doing wrong, I would get Mitch Ronning to go running with you and run behind you.
Okay.
And maybe he'll see something because he's my go-to guy for figuring out weird biodynamic stuff.
Really? Okay. That's great. That's great to know. So, yeah, I see Ryan there at Ronning, but...
But you might want to have the man check you out from behind.
Okay.
No offense, you know.
No, that sounds great. That's great advice. I mean, I'm going out of my mind trying to figure this out because if I can't run, you know, the quality of my life is way, way decreased.
Yeah, people don't seem to worry about people who are addicted to running the way we do about people who are addicted to pain meds. But
but
you may have a little monkey there.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good luck. In a related note, let's answer this email from Jackie in Kansas City. I'm going to shorten this because it's quite a long email, but Jackie woke up November 20th last fall with severe pain from her left buttock down the back of her left thigh and into her calf. And she went to the acupuncturist and then the chiropractor and finally saw a physiatrist and was diagnosed as having piriformis syndrome. She went to physical therapy for 5 weeks and she's been getting a lot better. But she's still having pain, so she went back to the physiatrist who recommended an MRI to investigate the low back and to clear the way for having pain injections at the local pain clinic, because, of course, they won't do that without an imaging study. Unfortunately for Jackie, she has personal health insurance with a very, very high deductible, and she does not have coverage for the MRI or for pain injections. You know, realistically, she's looking at $4,000 to $5,000 there in medical costs if she goes in that direction. So her question is, am I risking permanent nerve damage if I try to wait out the remaining symptoms? What feels like hamstring pain after sitting and non-painful but intermittent tingling on the left side? She's only using a pain medications occasionally and a heating pad every other day and a portable nerve stimulator, a TENS unit, from her physical therapist. And she's getting better. So, Jackie, what I would say is if you're improving, go ahead and keep with conservative management. The people who suffer persistent nerve damage are the people who actually have a disc that's undiagnosed or something else that's really putting hard pressure on the nerve, and they are generally not improving after 3 months. In the olden days, when getting an MRI on someone meant sending them 100 to 250 miles away, we had kind of a rule of thumb, which is we gave an acute disc rupture that we thought was an acute disc rupture about 3 months to resolve and begin to improve. And if the person at 12 weeks was improving and had decreased pain and decreased tingling, then we just let them improve and didn't get an MRI. In the last 20 years, with the advent of MRIs, the number of people receiving what was probably unnecessary back surgery has mushroomed as a result of people being afraid to sit on an injury that they can see when they put an X-ray film up and look at the MRI printout. It's hard to see an abnormal MRI and not want to do something about it, but in the case of acute back injuries, including disc injuries, all of the data support conservative management first and only going to aggressive management of those people who are failing conservative management, which you most definitely are not. Oh, we had a call off air from Jay, a local chiropractor, who treats piriformis issues a lot. Jay says posture is a big factor. He recommends sitting pigeon-toed or knock-kneed to relieve stress on the piriformis muscles. So, aiming your toes in, and I'm trying to sit that way, and I definitely do feel like it changes the location of where my body weight is centered. So something from a chiropractor, something basic and very useful. Thank you very much to Jay. One last email before we go any further. This one from Steve and Ben Lohman. Steve writes, "Hi, Doc. Haven't seen you in a while. As you now accept my insurance, my wife and I will be switching back to you." I could do a whole editorial on that one. My question, is there any problem with taking this IGF growth hormone in conjunction with my high blood pressure medicine, Toprol and Tyzak. Also, this product I'm talking about, IGF, made from antler velvet, is harvested in New Zealand and claims to improve libido. Any idea if this is true? Thanks, and looking forward to seeing you again. Well, Steve, briefly, any drug that you spend money on that says it will increase your libido probably will through the placebo effect. I think that insulin growth factor, which is what IGF is, has to be distinguished from growth hormone, which is somatotropin. Insulin-like growth factor is not going to raise your blood pressure. It could cause problems with blood sugar, as could growth hormone, and so it's important to monitor that. I don't think the New Zealand antler velvet derivation really makes a difference. Let's assume it really is identically these growth factors. I don't know whether when you take it orally, it'll actually get into your bloodstream in appreciable quantities, but I don't really see a huge harm in taking it as long as you monitor your blood pressure and your blood sugar, which I sincerely hope you actually are doing. You've been listening to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'll be back next week with more on healthcare reform, system dynamics, and answers to your questions and emails. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.